and welcome to The Image Doctors, part of the Nikonians podcast series. This is episode 47 for August 16th, 2007. I'm Jason Odell.
And I'm Rick Walker.
Thanks again for joining us, everyone, and we've got another exciting episode for you today.
Yeah, I think this will be a good one, actually.
So we've got a couple of things we want to talk about from our list, and we'll start with answering an email question from a listener. Mm-hmm. And about filters. Then we're going to talk about local editing during post-processing.
Burning and dodging and selective saturation boosts or reductions.
More of a philosophical
kind of
idea.
Yeah.
Not as more of philosophy rather than how to step-by-step mm-hmm. do everything. Mm-hmm. So, because there's just too many, that could be an entire episode.
Right.
And as always, we will have our weekly prescription. So let's get started with an email that we got not too long ago.
Right.
From a listener, Greg Mills, and he wanted us to cover filters. And I know we've covered, he's got a bunch of questions about filters, but his point was we've talked about them quite often, but we haven't really lumped them all into one episode.
Yeah, so we'll do that. And in addition to asking some of Greg's specific questions, I think we'll take just a couple minutes and talk about what the two of us actually use on a frequent basis in terms of filters.
Yep. So why don't we just start with that?
What
filters that we use on a frequent basis, and then we'll move to some specifics about different kinds of filters.
Okay.
But when I go on a shoot, I only usually put one filter in my bag, and that's a circular polarizing filter. Mm-hmm. Don't always use it, but it's there in case I need to. The only other filters that I have beyond that is I have a set of inexpensive Kokin P rectangular neutral density, graduated neutral density filters. Mm-hmm. And I think once upon a time I had a UV skylight filter, maybe a slight warming filter, but didn't use it a whole lot. That was in my film days mm-hmm. a long time ago. So like a skylight filter.
Right.
But pretty much the polarizer is the one if I keep something in my bag, because I can just screw that on to the front of the lens. Mm-hmm. And that's what I go with. And I imagine you do something pretty similar to that.
Nope.
Okay.
Completely different.
Okay.
Yeah. I use a lot more filters, I think, than you do. And partially it's just because of differing interests. And you know, I like more in the landscape realm and stuff mm-hmm. like that. So what I normally take with me when I go out, in addition to a circular polarizer, which, you know, we've talked about before, those are very useful just for a lot of types of photography. But I'll also have some other filters in there too. And if I'm shooting digital, then what I'll also take with me will include a neutral density filter. Not the that's in addition to neutral density grads, and I take a bunch of those.
You're talking about the regular screw-in, just X number of stops, neutral mm-hmm. density filter.
Well, kind of. What I used to take was a three-stop neutral density filter, you know, which cuts the light by three stops. But what I'm taking now is a Singray Very ND.
Right, the variable one.
Right, which goes from two stops to eight stops. It's pretty cool. And it is nice under certain situations if you want to get that blurred water effect or, you know, blurred subjects, things like that. So I'll take that. I like several other filters that they make. There's a thing called a color intensifier, and their latest version of it is called an LB, and it doesn't have as strong a filter factor, meaning it doesn't reduce the light transmission as much as their older ones. And what that does, just some subtle changes to greens and reds and oranges. And while you could get a similar look in post-processing, if you played with it enough, it's a little bit different than what I can easily get in either NX or Photoshop or whatever. And I like the look, especially for certain types of images, especially autumn colors and things like that. It's pretty nice. And since I do shoot, you know, a lot of film still, it's useful to me, you know, when I'm doing film. And so in addition to those things, and like I said, I use a lot more grad filters than you do. I usually take a one-stop hard, two-stop hard, three-stop hard, two-stop soft, and a reverse grad filter that's usually a a two-stop, you know, so a bunch of those things. And again, I kind of like using the same approach with digital that I do with film. So I'll use grad filters a lot when I'm shooting digital. Also got some other things that I tuck in there, like a blue gold polarizer that Singray makes. That one's kind of hard to use, but sometimes it can be interesting. My success rate is not high with that filter, but I'm still trying because I've seen some interesting things with it. And I'll stick a UV filter in there just in case I'm in a situation where I want extra lens protection. Have I ever needed it? No.
Yeah.
But it's in there.
Well,
just in case.
And that sort of brings us to all filters are going to modify the light.
Mm-hmm.
And each one has its, you know, each one has its own use. I mean, but the class of filters that you use most often, these neutral density ones,
mm-hmm.
whether they're graduated or otherwise, you're using that to, the function of those is to even out exposure, in shots where you've either, in the case of the graduated filters, where you have an uneven exposure across the frame. So you've got just too much light, too much dynamic range between the light and the dark. So you're going to use that to balance it out. So the classic application is you put the graduated, the dark part of the filter on the part of the frame that's on the bright part of the image, usually the sky. And then the clear part of the filter is over where the foreground is, and which is oftentimes in shade, especially sunrise, sunset types of images. And those work really great. And those kinds of circular polarizers, neutral density filters, graduated neutral density filters, they don't, if they're good ones, they should not affect the color of your image. They're not really special effects filters in the same sense that, you know, you're just trying to make a more pleasing image. Polarizer is sort of on the borderline. It doesn't adjust the color, but you're going to increase the contrast. So it does affect the overall feel that you can get from an image, bring up, make some colors pop, like dark blue skies, white clouds. It increases the contrast. We've talked about those in the past. Now, your other set of filters, like these blue gold polarizers, color intensifier, those are kind of like in the special effects filters realm. And there's other kinds. I mean, I've seen all kinds of funky gimmick filters, like ones that make little star effects on light sources, make lens flare kind of, you know, they do all kinds of funky
things. I've
never used anything like that.
No. Don't care for those shots.
Yeah.
To me, they look very 1970-ish.
They're gimmicks.
Yeah.
But now back to the fundamentals and parts of Greg's questions is, fundamentally, how can you get, how do filters come? You know, screw mount and drop in, and then rectangular. Those are the, those are the three kinds. And, Greg wanted to know which is better. Well, just depends on the application, I think.
Yeah. And here's what I would say. If you're using graduated neutral density filters, I think the best way to go are the rectangular ones that you can slide up and down and vary, you know, where the gradation line is on the image. You can get circular neutral density grads that'll go on just like a normal filter screw onto the front, but you're stuck with the gradation line just in one place, usually in the middle of the image. And that's not where you always want to put it. So I would definitely go with the rectangular ones.
Now the drawback of the rectangular filter system is that they can be a little bit cumbersome to use in the field.
Sure.
You have to get a filter holder that holds these rectangular pieces of, usually they're resin or plastic, you know, some kind of glass. They rotate. So the holder rotates, which is a good thing. You want that to happen, but it's easy to bump if you're not careful. And it pretty much removes the possibility of using your lens hood when you have these on there. And in some situations that can be tricky. And with the flat filter, you can get reflections if you're not careful on them. But most cases when you're using these kinds of filters, you're not pointed directly into the sun.
Right.
And so it's okay.
Yeah. I rarely have it, is a problem.
And these filters are, they have a tendency to scratch if you're not careful, if you don't store them properly, because they don't have any metal edge. Mm-hmm. You know, they're not in a frame.
Yeah. Like having said that, I've owned mine for years, and
if you get the good,
they're
ones,
just fine. Yeah.
Right.
They're not scratched up or anything.
So if you're going to get now, you know, the circular, I mean, the screw-in filters are really easy to use. For the most part, you just screw it onto the front of your lens. So you have to buy the filter and the right thread size. And that's one reason why when you're looking at that next lens to buy, you know, consider one thing to just in the back of your head to keep in mind is what's the filter thread on this? I have the luxury of having most of my lenses use the same, they share the same filter diameter. A lot of the Pro Nikon lenses have the 77 millimeter front thread, mm-hmm. which is nice because I can carry one polarizing filter with me, mm-hmm. and that's it. If you don't, there's other ways around that. You can get you either buy a second filter, or there's also step up and step down rings. And usually, you'd want to use a step up ring. You don't want to use a filter that's a smaller diameter than your lens.
So. Right. In a few cases, you can get away with that, especially longer focal length lenses, but for the most part, it doesn't work well. And I'll use step up rings on occasion. I've got a few lenses that are 72 millimeters in size or 62. And if I have a unique and fairly expensive filter that's, you know, a 77 millimeter one, because like you, most of my lenses use that size, mm-hmm. then, you know, a step up ring will allow me to use that filter with that smaller filter thread. That I have on some lenses.
Now, another part of Greg's email is, what about drop-in filters?
Well, I think when he's saying drop-in, he's talking about the rectangular
filter.
Okay,
well, there's another kind of drop-in
filter. Yeah, we'll talk about those in a sec. But he asked a question about, is there any reason why a circular polarizer can't be one that...
you put in a rectangular holder?
Right. And the obvious one is that if you actually had a rectangular circular polarizer, then you'd have to rotate it around to get the effect, and then that would screw up your grad filters that you were using too. Now, what does work with the Kokin holder, and I think it works with other ones too, is a filter that will slide into the back of it. And we've talked about that type before. I've got a couple single.
So you put a round filter into the rectangular slot.
Yeah, because there is a slot in the back of the Kokin P holder. And it works. It's a pain in the neck to use. We've talked about how I've damaged myself on it with that one. It has this knurled ring that you turn, and it's not easy to use. But you can make it work. And there are definitely times where it's nice to have both the circular polarizer and grad filters at the same time, because that circular polarizer will take reflection off of leaves and rocks and all sorts of stuff, and it's a very nice look. So that does work as an idea. Now, drop-ins, that's a different type of filter, and where you'll see that is on the super telephotos, typically. They'll actually have a little section on the barrel of the lens where you can slide a filter in there. And the reason that they use those is they can be much smaller in size than ones that would go on the front of the lens, like our 200 to 400s. You know, that would be a massive size filter. And instead, what there is that Nikon makes is something that slips into the barrel, and then you can turn it using a little control. In fact, I just got one of those to take on our trip that we've got to the Tetons in Yellowstone coming up soon.
The ANPAT's coming up, mm-hmm. yeah. And... you know, I'll give you the converse example. I used to own the Sigma 50 to 500 zoom. It doesn't use a drop-in filter. So it used something like an 86 millimeter front thread, you know, thread diameter front filter. Hmm. And just a skylight filter, just a UV haze filter for that thing was nearly $100. Yeah. And it wasn't even fancy one.
Of course, the circular polarizer that I was mentioning for the 200 to 400 is $250.
Correct. Like, but it comes in its own little special mount that allows you to rotate it.
Yeah.
But no, the polarizer for that 86 millimeter thread was substantially more too. Mm-hmm. Polarizers, no matter what kind you get, you need to be able to rotate them. And so, you know, again, when you're using them in the field, lens hoods can get in the way mm-hmm. a little time. Now, there's one neat lens out there that allows you to use a front polarizing filter with the hood, and that's the I believe it's the Tokina. I think it's their 80 to 400 mm-hmm. that Tokina makes. It's not a VR, but they made a special, there's a wheel in the in the lens hood that will grab on. There's a little rubber wheel, and it'll grab onto your filter and allows you to rotate the polarizing filter while you're using it.
It's kind of a cool idea.
But with any of those kinds of filters, or with any filter in general, you got to remember that you're going to lose a little light. So you're going to get a slower shutter speed than you would if you weren't using a filter. And you're putting another optical element into your into the path. So as a general rule, you know, the cheapest possible filter might not always be the best the best way to go.
Yeah. Now, Greg does ask the very controversial question about using protective filters. Now, neither of us use those. And I don't think we've ever had a problem with lens getting damaged or broken or anything like that.
Others will swear the opposite.
Yeah, others will swear the opposite. What I've found is that people that put protective filters on their lenses break them all the time. And if you don't put a protective filter on your lens, and you never have trouble with it. It's just that's the way it works. The filters break incredibly easily, and front elements of lenses don't. I don't know what to say about it. Really, it's just I've been photographing now with an SLR since I was 12 years old, so that's 33 years, and I've never ever damaged a lens front element or had a problem. So,
and neither have I.
The thing for me is, it's not that I think they're going to cause some big optical problem. I really don't. You know, unless you get a really cheap one that isn't multi-coated or anything like that. It's just because I do use filters with a lot of my photography, grad filters, polarizers, some of the other neat ones we talked about, I would be forever unscrewing one filter, storing it, putting a new one on, screwing it into place, then removing it, and then putting the protective filter back on. And it would just be an incredible nuisance and would slow me down. And I just haven't seen any big benefit to it.
Yeah. I mean, when I first bought a lens, I bought a protective filter because every camera salesman will try to sell you that with that fear of, well, you'll break your lens otherwise. But one of the things I've noticed lately is that Nikon lenses, all the lenses out there, it doesn't matter. All my lenses, whether they're Nikon, Sigma, Tokina, they all come with a pretty good lens hood nowadays. Mm-hmm. And that didn't always used to be the case, or it was a separate accessory. But that lens hood protects my front element from just about anything. And I don't mind if for whatever reason, if I crack the lens hood, I could get a new one and replace that pretty cheaply as well. And I also use my lens cap when I'm not using my lens when I store them. And I figure that'll protect the lens as well. You brought up a point. If the lens, you do run a potential issue when you create another glass air interface. You run the potential of adding lens flare if you don't have a really good multi-coated filter, like you mentioned. There are situations where you could potentially reduce the quality of your image.
Yeah.
But as far as protection goes, there is one application where you might want to use something like a UV or skylight filter to protect your lens. And that's if you're like at the beach and there's salt spray. Then I'll hear, you know, where there's a possibility of some water spraying on the front of your lens, then rather have that salt water hit a filter. And that's one application where it kind of made a little sense to me rather than a strictly physical protection function.
Yeah. I think one thing that always sticks in my mind is, you know, we've talked about, I think in the past, that when I was in college, I worked in a camera store and we loved selling protective filters because we made lots of money off of them, more than we did. We still made more money selling a protective filter than we did on the camera body. Believe me, we wanted to sell them. To help with that, we had in our display cabinet a lens, had the broken filter attached to it. And we talked about how, you know, that saved it. It was completely fake. It had been smashed with a hammer by the camera store manager and stuff so that we sold more of those things. The reality is I never saw someone bring in a lens that had been broken because they didn't use a protective filter. I saw lots of broken protective filters, but never actually a lens that was broken because it was missing one. And like I said, I've never had the problem. But if you want to use them and you really feel like that's going to help you, that's cool. Just neither of us use them.
Okay. I want to make sure we cover all of Greg's questions here because there's a lot of them in here.
Yeah.
One question he had was, which graduated neutral density filters should you get to start out with? Well, I mean, I bought the Kokin one simply because they're inexpensive. And just depends on how religious you want to be about using them. If they're going to be a major part of your kit, mm-hmm. my philosophy is always go for the best ones you can get. Because chances are they're made a little bit better and they'll last you a lifetime. I know you use the Singray, and that's considered to be sort of the top end mm-hmm. As far as neutral density. As far as a filter manufacturer, they're really good.
Yeah.
But that doesn't say you should have to buy these very expensive ones if you're starting out.
No, if your budget only supports getting the Kokins, get the Kokins.
It's better than not having
absolutely.
Them at all.
And in terms of what to use, the common recommendations you'll get are get something like a 2-stop soft, 3-stop hard, 2-stop hard. All of those are pretty useful. I don't like the Singray 3-stop soft. It's got the gradation all dorked up. I don't know why they make it that way. It should be made more like the 2-stop soft, which has the gradation in the middle of the filter. Instead, it's all skewed toward the top end, and it's not a very usable filter. But the 2-stop and 3-stop grad filters are very, very useful. Sometimes I'll stack things because the light can be so extreme, and I do have a 1-stop that sometimes I'll use just to darken a sky up a little bit, especially with film, but more often than not, I'll use it stacked with another one so that I end up with a 4-stop grad filter, like 3-stop and a 1-stop.
Right. Next topic we've covered before, but we'll just revisit that. Are there filters that you don't really need now that you've switched to digital versus what you might have done in film?
Yeah, and warming and cooling filters definitely fit in that realm.
Those are the big ones. We used to always say, hey, have an A1 or an A2. A2 warming filter if you shoot film. Gives a little more pop, especially on overcast days. Well, you can do all that now with just white balance adjustments.
Yeah, and that's the way to do it. If I am shooting film, I'll definitely have my A2 filters. I'll usually take a KR3 filter too. That's like a little bit stronger version of the same thing.
Now, as far as brands go, I've used the Tiffins, I've used the Hoyas. Pretty much, they're all decent. Some will try to.
I'd say the Tiffins are the cheapest.
They're the cheapest, but when I buy those, I always get the multi-coated flavor. So when I'm buying a filter, I don't just get the cheapest one, but I will always look for a multi-coated filter, mm-hmm. because this will have the anti-glare coatings on the glass, which usually means you're getting a somewhat better quality filter. But the Hoyas are considered to be very good. What's the other one out there that I'm thinking of?
Yeah, the ones that I tend to use.
I'm thinking of the screw-in filters.
Yeah, in addition to the Singray ones, which we talked about earlier, because they do make circular ones. B&W makes good filters, are very nicely made and of good quality. Nikon has some good ones. Same thing there. Hoyas, we already mentioned. I tend to stay away from the Tiffins because they're constructed differently. They're optically not quite as good as some of the others. And when you get into the brands that you've never heard of, just skip them.
Yeah.
You're going to end up likely with some optical problems, things that aren't quite flat or...
Right. Yeah. And that's something when you have to think about this, is that you're not just buying an accessory. We all want to save money when we buy accessories, mm-hmm. but you're buying an optical element that's going to go on your lens. And therefore, you want to make sure you have some quality glass. Just like you spent the money on that Nikon lens, why do you then want to put something that is of questionable optical quality in front of it? Because it's gonna distort the light coming through and potentially give you a worse image than if you hadn't used it.
Mm-hmm. And I think that hits, all of the mm-hmm. key questions that Greg has. So we appreciate the question being sent to us. It was a good one.
Yeah, and as always, if you have a question that you'd like to hear us answer on the air, just send us an email to talkradio@nikonians.org, and we'll gladly get back to you. And if it's really fun, we'll use it as a show topic. Mm-hmm. Now we're going to move along. We're going to talk about the philosophy of post-processing, but in specific, we're talking about localized editing.
Yeah, and one of the reasons that I wanted to talk a little bit about this one today is very often I'll see notes on the Nikonian site or other places that that talk about people wanting to be a purist and never do any post-processing. And to me, it's just so odd. Because I can remember when I was first getting into photography, you know, as a teenager and college student, things like that. And I took several photo classes. At that time, you know, there wasn't Photoshop and stuff. So it was all darkroom work. But I would swear, unless my memory has gotten funny, that we spent about a third of the time on the camera and the controls for the camera getting a shot, and the rest of the time on the darkroom. Mm-hmm. And that was considered a pretty normal thing. And all that darkroom work was very much a part of photography and an important part.
Well,
you know, the creative
process
didn't end when you snap the picture.
Right. You have to consider that what is the final product from photography? And for the last, you know, 100 years or so, the final product is the print.
Yeah.
And how you make that print.
And to me, the idea that it ends, that photography ends when you push that button, is just so bizarre. It to me, it's like a 1980s and 1990s artifact, and it's a machine print kind of mentality. And, you know, it's so foreign to what I think, because I think that, you know, the creative process goes all the way up to the time that you make that print. And so just a little, you know, rant, I guess, or whatever, but, you know, I don't get it. That's what I really loved about the darkroom, was being able to do those things.
Right. Now, does that mean that your camera cannot produce a perfectly acceptable image on its own, just if you shoot a JPEG and say, I'm done? Or
it
convert
could.
All your RAWs to JPEG
it could.
And say, I'm done?
It could.
Right, it could.
It depends on the image and the subject and what you want to do with it. But I think if you just leave it there, you're losing a whole aspect of photography and the creative process that really could enhance your images and make them better, just like it did with the darkroom.
Now, what you're talking about, however, is in contrast to completely altering images.
Right.
I mean, I know that there is a ethical issue out there. Thou shalt not retouch. You know, there's a difference between retouching mm-hmm. in terms of, and you know, and altering, and just getting a good print.
Right.
I mean, I think you have to do some amount of post-processing if you're serious about your prints to compensate for things like why did you use a neutral density filter? Grad? Well, you use it to even out the exposure. Some of that you can do in the darkroom, digital or otherwise.
Yeah.
And Lord knows Ansel Adams did.
Oh, yeah, to a huge degree.
So it's not that he spent time in the darkroom cloning out that tree branch that he didn't like, but we're talking about if you need to change the exposure locally to darken up an area by burning or to lighten up an area by dodging, mm-hmm. those are important things to do.
Yeah, and they can make a huge difference in the quality of the print. Now, we talked, you know, briefly there about ethics. What are you comfortable with?
What am I comfortable with?
In terms of changing on your image.
Well, mostly I never change anything.
Yeah.
I say mostly. Now, I went through a phase when I would scan in prints and I thought, well, this is great, because I had Photoshop, I think Photoshop 5 or 6 when I first got a scanner. And that was really fun and I can get rid of this. I mean, I'm not one to say that I wouldn't get rid of a power line in a blue sky if it was for me. I mean, it depends on the picture, but I rarely do serious cloning out of things.
Yeah, me either.
I mean, I don't get rid of stuff that's in the image. I mean, mostly I approach my photography, my post-processing, from the standpoint of what's in there is in there, and all I'm doing with the post-processing is enhancing certain features of the tone and color to give a more accurate representation of the feeling I got when I was there taking the picture in the first place.
Yeah, once in a while, and it's not very often, I'll take out a twig or something like that, but it's at about that level, and it's not very frequent. So I'm not
Now, here's an example of where it was used, and I had no issue with it whatsoever. I have a big wedding album upstairs of my photographs, and our photographers did everything in digital. And we had our wedding at the Broadmoor Hotel here in Colorado Springs, and they were doing construction. And on the top of one of the buildings, jutting into the sky, was this big crane, a big yellow crane.
Right.
They got rid of it, and I don't care. I don't, you know, because I'm the one who has... That picture has to please me.
Right.
And the fact that crane was really there on that day, And they didn't document it. In fact, they deliberately got rid of it. Doesn't bother me. But again, the purpose of that picture was to please me, the client, and remember that day as I remember it, which was my brain tuned the crane out.
Yeah.
I wasn't thinking about the crane. I was thinking about my wife, you know, and having a good time. But if I was going to submit a picture for photojournalism, it would be a different set of rules.
Mm-hmm.
I don't agree with the philosophy that says you can't touch your picture at all.
Yeah.
You know, that's ridiculous.
That's silly.
You know, but the guy who recently submitted a photograph on, and it was in CNN, he submitted a photograph of, you know, it was last year during the Middle East conflict where he had Photoshopped, he cloned in extra, you know, he clone stamped in extra smoke.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's just retarded, in my opinion.
Right.
You know, he didn't do a very good job of it either. It was pretty obvious when I looked at it. I was like, well, that's a really bad use of the clone stamp tool. But I don't think you should add or take stuff out of the photograph that are important details when it's conveying something that you're trying to document something.
Yeah, and for me, a lot of times, you know, since these aren't images that I'm selling as a photojournalist or whatever, it's just a matter of what do I enjoy doing. I don't enjoy doing things like, you know, cutting an elk out of one picture and pasting it in another. I've never done that. I've never done that with moons or things like that. I just don't like doing it. They always look fake to me, and I know that it's fake, and I just don't enjoy the image the same way. So I don't do it for reasons of personal enjoyment, I guess, in a lot of cases. So anyway, I just...
Yeah, no, and one thing I've tried that was the same thing, how many of us have ever taken a picture of an animal or a scene on a really crappy overcast day, and you get that white sky and you say, well, here's this bird, and I'm gonna put in a nice blue sky background in Photoshop and I'll use the clouds tool.
Yeah.
Boy, that looks awful.
Yeah, I've never done that
either. Every time I tried that, I ended up with something that looked worse than just the overcast image.
Yeah.
And it just looked processed and fake.
Now, what I will do on my images is, you know, once I've done the major tonal changes, you know, contrast
the
levels
global.
That are global, color balance things that are global, then I'll get in there and do some relatively minor tweaks to certain areas of the image. And what I will do are burns and dodges, so lightening and darkening specific areas of the photo. And that can be done either because the lighting level was inconsistent, or I just want to give emphasis and drama to a certain part of the image. I will sometimes also do local enhancements to color saturation. You know, for example, I was working on some images over the last couple of days that were done in the Smokies, and it was a, you know, waterfall scene. There were some nice fall leaves and rocks and stuff like that. And one of the things I did is just to bring out those leaves a little bit more, I did some local changes to saturation in that area, emphasizing them. And it's not to make it look fake. It's to make it look the way that I remembered them. Because sensors or film don't always capture things the way your eye sees them, or the way that your mind
perceives them. I mean, what's real?
Right.
You know, an image that you snap, you and I could be standing right next to each other, take the same picture. If I was using Velvia and you were using Provia, we'd get totally different images of the same thing. And what's to say which is right or wrong?
Right. And so it's all in that same kind of zone where it's not a major change to the image. It's a more minor one. And if you saw before and after, you know, hopefully you would say the ones with those changes were better images, but they're not huge changes.
Now, fundamentally, the way that both of us approach making localized edits, I would say that, would you agree that we both usually do them in a non-destructive workflow?
Yeah, but we have different approaches, right?
But I mean, we try to get it. And by non-destructive, what we mean is that you'd like to be able to save that file, whatever your file is, and go back to it later and not have whatever effects you just applied to it be baked in.
Right.
Because if you realize that maybe you overdid it, or let's just a more reasonable thought, next year I might learn a technique, or there may be a tool out there either as a Photoshop plugin or a functionality to Capture NX or whatever I might be using that didn't exist this year.
Mm-hmm.
And I can go back to my images. If I've baked in local contrast or color effects that maybe I don't like, I'd like to be able to get rid of them.
Yeah, otherwise you have to start from scratch again.
And hope you save the image from the, you know, the original.
Yeah.
So there's different ways of doing that. And I know the, and so let's start with the Photoshop way in which you do that. And so in Photoshop, almost all of the tools can be applied in either an adjustment layer or a new layer.
Mm-hmm.
And Photoshop has a dodge and a burn tool, for example. But if you use those, it works on the background layer and it bakes in the effect. The only way you can undo them as long as they're fresh and you haven't saved the image and closed it. But you can't undo those steps later on. So what you do is something different, and you want to walk us through what you do based just real simply. You create another layer, right?
Yeah, if I'm burning and dodging, then I'll create a new layer, and I'll specify the soft light option, and there's a little box in there where you can have it fill up with the 50% gray or something like that. And that creates that new layer. The image doesn't look any different at that point, and it puts a mask on it too. And the next thing I'll do is I'll hit Control I to invert the mask and turn it all. I'm thinking of something else.
Sorry,
I'm jumping ahead.
Strike that
last part. Okay.
But you do
so
use
I've got the layer,
a
and then
brush we'll, tool, right?
Yeah, and then I'll grab the paintbrush, and if I want to darken an area, you know, in other words, burning it, I'll pick black and have a low opacity of like 15 or 20% or whatever, and then just paint on the image in those areas, and it just gradually builds it up. It's really easy to control. If I want to lighten an area, I'll hit X, and that switches white and black. And then I'll paint on, you know, with the brush again, and that'll lighten a certain area.
And use a nice soft brush.
Mm-hmm. And you can find this technique documented in lots and lots of Photoshop books, so just look it up. But that's usually how I'll do burning and dodging. I like it. It's easy to control, and it keeps it in a layer, so I could either turn it on and off or, you know, whatever.
And at the same time, if you wanted to do another effect, you can use the adjustment layer function. You could apply like a curves adjustment, and then by using the layer mask and the brush tool.
Is where I do the Control I thing to invert. I'll first put a curve on there and affect the whole image, and then hit Control I, which will mask it out.
And then you reapply it to where you want.
Yeah, with white and just certain areas, and it's really easy to control.
And these are all tips that are in Photoshop books, like you mentioned. Yeah. So this is not
hard to describe in a podcast.
Technical details. But the beauty of that approach is that when you then save your file as either a layered TIFF or usually a PSD document at this point, those layers remain, and they don't affect the background, the core image. And if you wanted to remove them at a later time, all you have to do is just delete that layer or go back in and just change the parameters. I think with like a curves adjustment layer, you can even change the curve.
Oh, absolutely.
After the fact. So
you can do that with most of those.
Right. Yeah. And so that's the reason why you do that is you can get back. So if you're using Photoshop to do your post-processing and you've never tried using adjustment layers or just layers, it is a technique we would strongly recommend because it allows you to have a non-destructive workflow.
Yeah. And once you've learned how to do it with one thing, like color saturation or whatever, you've pretty much learned how to use it for all the others. And it's not complex. It's really pretty simple, and it's actually kind of fun.
Mm-hmm. Now, that's the Photoshop way. You can also do this in Capture NX with any tool that you use as an edit step. And while NX doesn't create layers, it effectively, with layer masks, it effectively gives you the same flexibility with the NX brush tool. Mm-hmm. And so for me to, let's say I wanted to change the levels and curves for just a slight area, what I would do would be to create a new edit step in the edit list on NX and adjust the levels and curves. And it first applies it to the entire image. But then while I have the dialog box for the, let's say it's the levels and curves tool, while that dialog box is still open, I'll click the plus brush. And when you click the plus brush in NX, it immediately deselects the effect from the entire image and then allows you to use a paintbrush to paint back in the effect where you want it. Conversely, I could do it the opposite way. I could create the effect, which is applied by default to the entire image globally, and click the minus brush. And if I click the minus brush, then it leaves the effect on, and I can erase it from parts of the image. And you can do that, go back and forth between the two brushes. You can set the opacity, and it's got a view where it's similar to a layer mask where you can ask you to show the selection. You can see what it's doing, or you can see where you've painted.
Yeah, and just like same with the Photoshop version, it's really easy once you just learn the basics of it, and it's also quite a bit of fun.
And the only difference between those two techniques, there's no difference in terms of what they accomplish. You get the same effect on your image. The only difference is how they're stored in the file. In Photoshop, it's you have a basically a TIFF-based image, you know, an RGB processed image, and you've added some layer data to it. In Capture NX, you can do this while you're still working on the RAW, and it's not necessarily stored in the same way. So you can get a size. I mean, I've found that you can get a file size advantage if you still do it in your RAW file. But they work effectively the same way. You can come back to that file, and if you've saved it as a Photoshop file with layers or as a NEF file in NX, you can come back to that and delete those edit steps or those layers later on. And one neat thing you can do is, if let's say you're a JPEG shooter and you use NX, you can save your JPEG as a NEF, and that will save those edit steps, which gives you that same non-destructive workflow as if you had opened it JPEG in Photoshop and done layers. So it's the same idea, basically.
Now, for this kind of stuff, you pretty much use just NX, right?
Mostly. Yeah. That's where I've just lately, that's where I've been. There are clearly there are tools in NX or there are tools in Photoshop, I should say, that aren't available in NX, but those tend to be the pixel moving tools like your clone and your healing brush, and not your enhancement tools like your levels and curves or your dodge and burn types of tools. Yeah. So,
And for me, I use kind of a hybrid. Sometimes I'll use NX for certain image, you know, like if I want to darken a sky or something like that, and I've got tree branches and leaves blocking a portion of it. NX works great for that.
Oh, because of control points.
Yeah, because of control points. And control points are really pretty cool. And I'll use those at times for selective saturation adjustments in a certain area and stuff. Burning and dodging, I almost always do in Photoshop. And sometimes I'll do the saturation stuff there too. It's just, you know, to be honest, it just depends on what mood I'm in.
Yeah, and I would say
back and forth, and they both work well.
I would say the reason why I do my steps in NX has nothing to do with quality or of the tools. I'm not saying that NX does it better than Photoshop. They both do it probably the exact same way in terms of what image you get out at the end of the day. I do it because of my workflow philosophy, which is I like to save everything as NEFs without converting them to TIFFs first in Photoshop if I can get away with it. I would much prefer to save an edited NEF file with edit steps as a NEF at 15 megabytes or so, than a layered PSD file, which with adjustment layers, they don't get too big. But if you start adding in complex masks and you start doing some other stuff, like we talked about the selective sharpening or noise reduction, those layers where you've actually copied RGB image data make your file size get really big in a hurry. And you can go from a 70 megabyte 16-bit TIFF to 130 megabyte or 150 megabyte 16-bit PSD file very quickly. So from a workflow standpoint, that's why I'm doing them in NX. It has nothing to do with the quality. I mean, if you're familiar with doing these things in Photoshop, you'll get just as good quality either way. So it has nothing to do with the tools being better or worse in any application. If you know what you're doing in either of these applications, you can get excellent results.
Right.
So is that... nail that one down.
Yeah. And if you're not doing that kind of stuff right now with your images, at least consider it, try it, look up some of these techniques in some of the books that are out there. I think you'll find that the final image is really going to be better, and it's going to bring on an area of creativity in the process that you may not have had before.
And I think just to emphasize something that you said, but just not straight out, is mm-hmm. that when you do these kinds of, especially things like dodging and burning, subtlety is your friend.
Oh, yeah. Don't overdo it.
You can really make it look strange if you start applying some of these dodge and burn effects too intensely. So you really, like when you were using your brush, the reason why you set the opacity to something like 15% is so you get a very subtle effect that you can just sort of build up. Mm-hmm. You don't want to overdo it because it'll look very strange. Yeah. And then it becomes an obvious retouch job. And that's not what you saw out there.
Yeah. And the saturation controls get misused a lot of times too. See some people just doing it way too much. And you look at that and you say, ugh, digital. And that's not what you want.
So, excellent. So try that. I think it's, you know, you don't need to do it on every image, but for the ones that you really like, it's something to think about mm-hmm. doing. Mm-hmm. Okay. We'll move on to our photo prescription. And,
this is a simple one.
It's a simple one. And so I was reading the prescription and what you wanted to talk about is, which pictures to show your friends and family. And it got me thinking about vacations, and I just got back from a vacation, and, you know, you go out and you take, and I didn't bring I just brought my point and shoot camera, mm-hmm. but I just wanted to mention that when I was on vacation, my casual observation, my Nikon to other brand ratio was 5:2 of all the DSLRs. I only saw 7 DSLRs when I was down in Mexico. But of the 7 I saw, 5 were Nikons.
Did that make you feel good?
It made me feel really, really nice that it clearly Nikon is doing something right on the consumer line. I saw 2 D50s, 2 D40s, and a D200. So it really says that you know, they're doing really well. Conversely, I saw 2 other, I'm not sure, I think they were Canons, but I don't know what model they were. I think Rebels of some kind, you know, consumer level. It was just kind of interesting. But we're going to talk about when you get back from this trip or whatever you might have done or any event. Let's say you just took pictures of your family. And then you're going to show your pictures to your friends and family. And once upon a time, this was like a slideshow. And we'll talk about slideshows in another episode because that's a whole topic. But
don't show every picture you took.
That's right.
This is a simple tip to enhance your reputation as a photographer. Do some editing.
Absolutely.
And, you know,
and by editing, you mean pick the keepers. We're talking about editing out the culling out shots, not necessarily post-processing.
Right.
You're talking about culling out shots that are actually the good ones. Look at the ones and don't show the out-of-focus ones or the ones where the head's chopped off
or just a lot of redundant photos.
Yeah. And that brings up something I used to do because, you know, in the film days, it was always, well, if you want to make sure you get one good picture, take 2 or 3 pictures of the same thing.
Nothing wrong with that.
No, but then don't show them
one.
In the slideshow.
Yeah. And it's amazing what some people will do, you know, even with websites, they'll upload every photo they took and you look on their site and it's just a whole bunch of images that look the same or a lot of mediocre ones. Get it down to a small number. And most of your friends don't want to see hundreds and hundreds of photos from a trip that you took.
10,
yeah, well, 10, or 30 or yeah. 40 or, you know, whatever. Just pick out some of the ones that were really representative of what you did and what you saw and make them want more, you know, when you finish, as opposed to being just frankly tired of looking at the pictures. You're again, going to be perceived as a lot better photographer if you just show the really good ones. So it's a simple thing to do, whether it's a slideshow with your friends or if it's 4x6 prints that you've made or a website that you've produced.
Yeah.
Smaller number of quality photos is always better.
And when you're on your vacation taking those pictures, when I saw those 7 DSLRs, I only saw 2 people using the lens hood correctly. So that'll be a bonus tip. Use your lens hood. You'll get better pictures. Yeah. I saw a lot of people using their camera where the lens hood was in
reversed
position and they're taking pictures in bright sunlight. I'm sure they didn't care, but it's just one of those nice things. So, but yeah, if you show only the good pictures, people will think you're a better photographer than you really are.
Absolutely.
The pros I've met, they didn't make their reputation by showing the rejects.
No, they
And they
have a lot of rejects.
Yes, they do.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thanks for joining us again today. Tune in, as always, every 2 weeks on Thursdays for the Image Doctors at Nikonians podcast. You can get all our episodes at podcasts.nikonians.org. Download those and check out the show notes there, too. So if you want to see when what we covered in each episode, that's a good way to find out. Mm-hmm. Until next time, we'll sign off. See ya.
All right. Bye-bye.